Tip Today with Fran Curry.
With Slattery's Garage, puck on. You can't beat experience. With over 50 years maintaining Peugeot cars and vans, we like to call ourselves the experts. Call Slattery's Garage for a free vehicle health check today. 067 24111 or slatterysgarage.ie.
1800 938 007. The text and WhatsApp is 083 311 3311. And don't forget, we have that lovely prize for you as well, because we're giving you a €50 voucher to give to spend at Shoe for You in Clonmel. And you can say hello to the summer fabulous shoes from Shoe for You. It's based on your interaction with us by text and WhatsApp. So if you put Shoe for You at the end of your contributions, we will pop you into the draw. It's as simple as that. And 083 311 3311. All right, it's time for Global News with Thomas Conway. He's in studio with me. Good morning to you, Thomas.
Good morning, Fran.
Busy day around here. We're all running around the place. You're going to start with Ukraine, I suppose, and the difficulties there, even though there is a package being made available now.
Finally, lo and behold, we had to wait long enough. This was a long time coming. So over the weekend, the US Houses of Congress passed a $60 billion military package for Ukraine. Now, it also contains money for other causes, for the Middle East and for Taiwan. But the vast majority of it, the bulk of it, is going to be devoted to Ukraine. And they needed this so badly. Many will say it's 6 months too late, that Russia have already dug in the interim, that Ukraine running short of supplies, short of ammunition. And one thing which hasn't really been mentioned, but it's true, short psychologically of motivation, because Ukraine, I think, has kind of felt that the West has left them behind to a certain extent in recent weeks. Now, this will help. The fact that Biden is going to, he's about to sign this through in his desk. I don't think he's signed the legislation yet, but he will in the forthcoming days. And it will give slight relief to those Ukrainian soldiers on the front line.
It's sort of only a sticking plaster, really, if this war is to continue.
It is, because Russia is winning. And that is the simple fact of the matter. And I think now we are beginning to see, you know, at the start of the war, we were all astonished because Ukraine obviously outperformed all expectations. We expected Russia to come in and crush them within days. That transpired not to be the case. But now I think as the war extends on into its third year, we're seeing maybe the differences in manpower come to show. And just the sheer number of troops that Russia has at its disposal. The Russian army is a massive army. I couldn't put the total number of troops, but in comparison to Ukraine, it dwarfs that of Ukraine. And we're starting to see that. Vladimir Putin has a lot of soldiers he can call on, that he can flow directly into the front lines there, and they're inflicting damage, and they're moving the line of attack kind of further. They're making incremental but significant gains. We saw that town Avdiivka fall just a couple of weeks ago. There is now reports that they're approaching Kharkiv, and they're targeting Kharkiv. Is Ukraine's second largest city. Many people will know it, in the east of the country near the Russian border. Reports that the Russian military is targeting that as a potential offensive operation. Yeah, so
you'd wonder what's going to happen then for the future, Thomas, because, I mean, in the event of, we'll say, Trump becoming president, I mean, you know,
And there is a great unknown there, because, to be honest, I mean, my opinion on it is Trump could do anything. He could literally do anything. He could row in behind Ukraine. Surprisingly, he's capable of doing that, you know. But the more likely scenario, he has showed, you know, that he has a kind of a tentative alliance with Vladimir Putin in the past. He has said he'll be able to solve the war in a day. Now, that's
24 hours.
24 hours, yeah. Now, and that's usual. That's Trump's usual bluff and bluster. You know, he goes on about that. But the unknown, I think there's a fear of the unknown when it comes to Trump, and a fear that he will hold up key military aid for Ukraine.
But people mightn't want to hear this, but, I mean, Russia they're not beatable in terms of what what Ukraine can do.
I agree with you. And, you know, I wish I wasn't saying it. I wish I was here saying that Ukraine could totally vanquish Russia from all their territory and liberate the Donbass region, liberate Crimea and get their country back. And that's, you know, that's what a lot of people are hoping. But that is just not... Not a feasible prospect at this moment in time, because I think Zelensky is going to have to come to the negotiating table. I mean, ultimately here, what we're looking at is probably Ukraine relinquishing some of its territory to Russia, maybe that Crimea region, that Donbass region, to fall under Russian control. I think, and it's a while away yet. Okay, I mean, Ukraine will keep fighting, and this military package will give it a renewed push and a renewed motivation, a pep in its step. But ultimately, we are looking at a negotiated solution here. And diplomatically, I'm sure this is being talked about in circles in and around the Ukrainian military, in and around Volodymyr Zelensky, that there's going to have to be some territorial losses here.
Are there elements of Ukraine that have given up on this already? Because you're speaking as well in some of your notes here about draft dodging.
Yeah, draft dodging.
You know, the younger people who are away from the front line, almost carrying on with their lives and not wanting to be part of this war.
And that has crept in, and I've read about it in recent days. Obviously, I haven't been to the country, I haven't seen it firsthand, but the reports coming out of Ukraine are that young people in their droves are either leaving the country or kind of choosing to blissfully ignore the war. Now, I don't want to sound critical. You know, they're a war-torn nation and it's exceptionally difficult for everybody out there. But there is a growing feeling that they're kind of fed up with the fighting.
Because, of course, fighting is going... We think of this in terms of the last few years, but this has been going on since 2014, really.
It has, really. And, you know, Kyiv is largely functioning now. Yes. You know, the major cities, Kyiv and, you know, maybe Odessa, some of the other ones, are functioning. I won't say normal. There's still alarm sirens going off. There's still...
But you're talking about nightclubs and...
So
hipster bars and all of this.
You know, a crumb of normal life has kind of returned.
Yeah,
and you kind of wouldn't blame people always for wanting to get back to the reality, get back to normal life. But in the east, the conflict rages on.
I'm reading between the lines of your notes here. Are some Ukrainian people almost holding their hands up and saying it's inevitable we're going to lose territory?
That's what I sense. That's exactly what I sense, because I think there is an acknowledgement now that, as you said a second ago, Russia are virtually unbeatable when it comes to the east of the country. They've been controlling those territories since 2014, and there is a degree of loyalty to Russia in those territories. I was looking on Twitter just before I came on air, and Steve Rosenberg, BBC's Russia correspondent, was going through the morning papers there. Very little mention of the Ukrainian military aid package. Very little mention of any of that. Russian society is largely insulated from any of that, any kind of negative news, and they're choosing to view it still as a special military operation, and a military operation that is going largely to plan, even though we know it's not. But certainly in recent days and weeks, Russia has gained the upper hand, and bar there's a drastic turnaround in fortunes, as I said, this military aid package will definitely help. It will definitely give them pep in their step.
It's a sticking plaster. Is it possible? I don't know how many people on both sides have been killed, but it goes into hundreds of thousands. Well,
like the BBC published a figure saying 50,000 Russian troops last year have perished in the conflict so far. I'm not sure the equivalent on the Iranian side. I couldn't give you a figure for that.
Right.
But it's
it's a lot of people.
It's on that scale.
Is it possible, Thomas, that this will end with nothing to benefit the Ukrainian people, really, at the end of it? That, I mean, if Russia ends up being dominant in the Donbass area, that's what they wanted anyway. And so have people died in vain here?
Yeah, and it's painful, and you can look at it in those terms. Now, I mean, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky will advocate that, you know, Slava Ukraine, and they're fighting for their country, and, you know, they put, you know, many lives have been put on the line, and he has perhaps stopped a total invasion of Ukraine, because that was a prospect at the initial, at the outset of the invasion, that Ukraine would simply be run amok with Russian soldiers and Russia would totally take control of the country. To Ukraine's credit, in fairness, to its enduring credit, that has not transpired to be the case. But certainly when you look at the east of the country and you look at the degree of suffering that is occurring, the degree of casualties that are occurring there as a result of this war, and you kind of feel, well, if Russia are going to gain this territory anyway, you know, what is to gain from this? It's an invidious position that Zelensky is in, and, you know, he has tried some tactical manoeuvres. He's changed his main general, you know, he's taken Zeluzhny away. He was the commander-in-chief, put in a guy called Alexander Sirsky, and he maybe has brought a new dynamic to it, but whether it's enough remains to be seen. It's an invidious position for Ukraine. It's going to be very difficult. Hopefully this new military package will give it some more ammunition to be able to plough into those Russian forces. But I think myself, like you've suggested there, the east of the country is going to be condemned to Russian rule.
And just briefly, before we move on, because you alluded to it there, the Russian support that is already in those areas, and people with who might see themselves as culturally
ethnic Russians.
It
is there and it does exist. And, you know, there is a degree, there has been a degree of loyalty to that. And I'm not for a second excusing the Russian invasion or anything like that. But there is a degree of loyalty in the east of the country towards Ukraine. Many of them are Russian-speaking citizens. Now, some of them have been alienated by Russia's invasion. It's important to say that. Some have actually been put off Russia. Some who may have been kind of aligned with Russia initially have been just totally put off by Vladimir Putin's conduct and his invasion. But at the same time, there's a degree of loyalty there. And as long as that remains, I think Vladimir Putin will have an incentive to work to take control of that part of the country. And he is under control of that now. And it doesn't look like he's going to cede ground anytime soon.
Joe Biden's other headache, of course, is Israel-Iran and those events there as well. It is, as you describe, a diplomatic tightrope, isn't it?
He is. He's walking a diplomatic tightrope here. It's extremely difficult. Now, in recent days, I mean, we had, I wasn't here last week, but obviously we had the major Iranian attack, the 300 missiles coming in. Israel managed, with the help of the UK, the US, Jordan and various armed forces, managed to take down most of those missiles. So it was a success from an Israeli military point of view. They then launched an offensive during, I think, was it Friday morning? They hit the province of Isfahan in Iran. I think that was largely a symbolic gesture.
Yes.
It was the lowest possible grade attack that they could manage, because they do not want a regional confrontation. And both sides, I think, both Iran and Israel, to this point have underestimated each other and miscalculated about each other's intentions. I think Israel had no idea that Iran would launch a direct strike when Israel struck that Iranian consulate on April 1st and killed that Iranian commander and seven others. I think they had absolutely no idea that Iran was to respond with such force and such overwhelming force that they would send that barrage of rockets. Now, fortunately, Israel had the resources to shoot it down. But all this is happening, and I was watching on the
BBC. But only with help from the Americans.
Only with help. And Israel, it should be said, has this Iron Dome missile system, which is this incredibly complex, sophisticated missile system capable of shooting down incoming objects. And it's, you know, it's extremely proficient, and it can target very precisely the military targets. But it did need the help of the Americans, the UK, the Jordanians as well. They all got in it. So it was a joint operation there. But while all this was happening, and I was just watching on the BBC News last night, you know, the suffering in Gaza continues. You know, the blood count continues to mount, and the Palestinian casualties, I think we're up in the region at 34,000-35,000 at this stage. And it is just a deplorable situation that is taking fold there. Rafah, this is the next site of, I suppose, invasion. And Benjamin Netanyahu, he's out this morning as saying that the US has vowed to place sanctions on sections of the Israeli military that have, you know, acted inappropriately, I suppose. Netanyahu has said he will resist those sanctions. You know, he's incredibly resolute and he's incredibly determined.
And is it very simplistic, the people who are saying, okay, the Americans are calling the Israelis out on this and saying that this is inappropriate, and they're still supplying them with munitions and with all of that. But of course, if they don't, Israel is vulnerable to the countries around them in terms of the Iranian proxies.
Yeah, and you have Iranian proxies in there. You have Hezbollah.
We're saying we want to wipe these people off.
Precisely. Yeah. So it's a very... That is how difficult a situation it is for Joe Biden at this point in time, because you have those Iranian proxies. You have Hezbollah in Lebanon and the northern Lebanese border. They are particularly probably the strongest pro-Iranian militia. You have the Houthis in Yemen, which are still causing all sorts of problems to the shipping routes in the Red Sea down there and in the Gulf. So you have these,
and Hamas, of course,
in Palestine or in the Gaza Strip itself. So you have all these actors there operating, you know, with the tacit help of the Iranians, with support from the Iranians, and the US is doing its best to fund Israel to keep the, you know, keep ammunition flowing and to ensure that it's able to protect itself. But Israel is then persecuting this bloody war of aggression against a lot of Palestinian, innocent Palestinian civilians.
Is the saber rattling between Israel and Iran, is that sort of finished now? Have they both sort of saved face on this?
I get a sense that they have kind of moved on, that there is, you know, they've closed that chapter for now, that last Israeli attack was, you know, it had to be conducted on Israel's part, but it didn't do much damage. There were no fatalities as a result of that. And I think that Iran is probably happy to close the book there, because Iran as well doesn't want to become embroiled in a large-scale regional conflict, and nobody across the region really wants that. But we did come perilously close. I mean, I thought myself for a few days there that, you know, Jesus, this is going to escalate seriously. And we're lucky that we have been brought back from the brink in terms of that regional crisis.
Hopefully so. Where Biden is concerned, and domestically then, how this is affecting...
How this is playing out, yeah. And it will have a significant impact on his election later this year, because there is significant polling evidence showing that a majority of younger Americans disagree with the United States' support for Israel because of their conduct in Gaza, because of the innocent civilian suffering and the civilian casualties there. So there is a large degree of younger people that are alienated. I'm not sure those are voters that will migrate to Trump necessarily. I think they may be more likely not to vote at all or to vote for an independent candidate. Trump has been kind of... He hasn't been silent. He has spoken out at times on the issue. He's even come to criticise, given slight criticisms of Israel in recent weeks over its conduct. He said it's not a good look for Israel. You know,
but of course he's been pro-Israel.
He has been staunchly pro-Israel. Yeah. He put in place a botched kind of peace plan a couple of years ago, which was heavily weighted in Israel's favour. And you would expect him to continue that should he regain the presidency. But this is having major implications for Biden. Now, not to the extent that other issues, you know, some other issues like the southern border. I mean, I've spoken about that before. If there is one issue that is going to take down Biden in this election year, it's not going to be his age and it's not going to be his gaffes. It's going to be immigration and that southern border, because it's causing a serious problem down there.
We normally ask you to have a look at a historic figure first. If you don't mind, I'm going to postpone.
Yeah.
Look, because I think he deserves far more time than we have, if that's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, no, Thomas, I can't wait to do it. Yeah.
Can we look to what we should be looking out for this week? And Orban and Farage.
I caught sight of this in Brussels last week. I kind of couldn't. So Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, right wing, notorious Hungarian Prime Minister, and Nigel Farage, aka of Brexit fame in the United Kingdom, got together for this little kind of right wing fiesta in Brussels.
But it
didn't happen. The Brussels authorities came in and kind of stamped it out, which, as much as I disagree with the two of them and their views on politics, was probably unfair and was probably a violation of free speech.
You'd imagine so.
You would certainly imagine so. It's caused all sorts of, you know, people to speak out against
it. What did they base their intervention on?
I think it was that there was unrest happening, that it was stoking, stoking the flames. Yeah, that it was a provocative conference and that it could lead to...
It's played into Farage's hands in our
It has, precisely, you know, and they have used it as leverage. It's an interesting... It's a little side, you know, it's not significant in the grand scheme of things. I mean, Orban is a significant player. Farage is kind of an outsider in British politics now. He's become kind of an outlier in recent
Mr.
years.
Mr. Brexit and all of
since
that.
Since the Brexit referendum, since his kind of, that was his raison d'etre, and it's happened now.
He has a huge following on the
He seems to be quite popular. He does. He seems to have retained his popularity. You see, he has charisma. You know, like him or hate him, he does have that element of charisma, and he's able, he knows how to work and all audience, much like Trump does, much like many other right-wing politicians do. So he is able to do that. But certainly this little event in Brussels...
And just briefly, talk to me about the Indian elections, because I'm intrigued at this, because it's so vast and huge.
And I can't wait. I'm going to preview this in full next week. Yeah. But almost a billion voters, the scale of it is off the scale. It's off the scales, literally. You have stories of... voting marshals having to trek across kind of forests and mountainous terrains just to get to a single voter in some remote, distant part of India. It is a massive operation. At the end of it, though, there is only probably going to be one winner, and that's going to be the incumbent Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And Modi has an iron grip on power. He's been there a decade, believe it or not. It feels he's been there that long, a full decade, and he will continue to. Now, there's a coalition of parties that are up against him that will challenge him, and in certain states may gain the upper hand. But his party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP as they call it for short, has the upper hand here and is likely to swoop to victory.
It's the sheer, I was reading a piece about this over the weekend, the sheer logistics of this.
It's incredible. I mean, you think, you know, just the numbers alone, close to a billion voters.
But you won't have a result for
it. We won't have a result. Yeah. I mean, it has started already, so it kicked off last Friday. We won't have a result until well into June. So that just takes you how long the voting, the counting and all the processes take. I'll preview it in detail next week. Yeah. It's going to be fascinating. You know, it's...
Please do. Because I'm fascinated by it, in fact. And is there parliament, I mean, does it reflect the old English setup as we do, indeed?
So it's called the Lok Sabha. It's the lower house of parliament. It's a bit like the Westminster model. Yeah, it is.
But they don't have a higher house.
No, they don't have an upper house. So it's unicameral. So it's a single chamber there. But it is based off, of course, the British legacy there. The British having ruled there until, 1949, was it, 52? So the legacy of colonial rule is there, but it is it's a thriving democracy, India. Now it's imperfect, it has its flaws, but this is the largest ever democratic exercise on the planet, and you know, we can hope it's very
really
success.
We really must talk about it more, because I think it's a fascinating story indeed. Thomas, great to see you.
Thanks very much indeed.
News and information is coming up.
Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry.
In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Peugeot dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.